Okay, everybody. Welcome to our last installment of Adventures in American Judaism. This is literally the most playful of our discussions. Mitzvah merchants and the creation of a Jewish children's culture. We'll get to him, our minifigure, Lego minifigure, in a little bit. First, I want to introduce or reintroduce everyone to Peter Berger, who passed away probably a few years ago. Peter Berger was a leading sociologist, social thinker of American religion. His first major book, one that really put him as a major figure among American public intellectuals, was his Heretical Imperative, published in 1979. At that time, Berger wrote the following about religion writ large in America. Yet those who affirm an orthodox or even moderately orthodox version of Jewish identity continue to define the latter as such a fact. Their problem is that they must affirm it in the face of empirical evidence to the contrary. The orthodox precisely defines Jewish identity as destiny, while the social experience of the individual reveals it as an ongoing choice. In other words, we are not obligated to do Judaism, Orthodox, Reform, Conservative, doesn't matter. We opt in every single morning. You opt in, or I'll only speak for myself. I opt in as an Orthodox Jew every single morning. If I wanted to, I could opt out or just simply not opt in the following day, and I could opt in the next day. There's no religious policing of my decision-making as a religious or lack thereof religious person. The dissonance between definition and experience is at the core of every orthodoxy in the modern world. The orthodox defines himself as living in a tradition. It is of the very nature of tradition to be taken for granted. This taken for grantedness, however, is continually falsified by the experience of living in a modern society. The orthodox must then present to himself as fate what he knows empirically to be a choice. This is a difficult feat. And so Berger at this time, although he would change his mind decades later, is a case about tradition-bound faith, a term that I like very much. Groups that find themselves bound to some sort of religious tradition, using Orthodox Judaism as a test case, was not long for American religion or American life writ large. It just wouldn't work out. Everything was now a choice in our modern techno Democratic society, he put it, Berger did. And so if people had to constantly opt in, what are the chances that any faith, any tradition-bound faith community would have its members and its adherents continuously opt in day after day after day? Well, the reason they would opt in is because they like it. And that's exactly what Berger he admits much decades later about how his prediction that tradition-bound faith and Orthodox Judaism being a good example to his mind would eventually fade away. They would liken there was tremendous infrastructure in the Orthodox community. Here's a quote about Rabbi Aaron Cutler, who's a really important case when we're talking about the yeshiva world and children's culture. He didn't furnish the materials, but he was sort of the lodestar for its thinking. Rabbi Cutler, right, the leader of Beis Medrash Gavoah and the Orthodox community in Lakewood, New Jersey, was to be the diadem of Torah Masora, which was an organization. Give me 1 second. Sorry, I'm calling an audible just to remove certain things from my screen. During his 18 years that he served as a spiritual authority of Torah Masora, again, an organization dedicated to populating Jewish day schools, private schools throughout the country, starting in the 1940s, Shraga Feivel and Belovitz was its sort of thought leader and executive leader until his death. About Rav Aaron Cutler in 1962, the organization saw its greatest growth. Not only was he concerned with the qualitative increase of day schools, but he spurred educational and qualitative improvements as well. And here is the chart, which Alvin Schiff, called the day school movement in the 1940s through when he wrote his book in 1965, I believe, is that this is a graph which charts the rise of the day school movement from just a bunch in 1917. But you see that huge growth of enrollments, topping over 60,000. Today, there are about 250,000, according to, the latest, Avichai studies that petered out a couple of years ago, but there are some 250,000, children in Jewish day schools, not just Orthodox, in the United States. But you see that huge rise really from just a couple hundred, see my cursor, to 10,000 in the mid 1940s. And then it just jumps, much to do with financial resources. But also a buy-in in, post-war America to the Jewish day school movement. Take a look about when we're talking about the yeshiva world for a second. This also comes from Alvin Schiff's book. In 1965, of the major yeshivas and its populations, you'll see Yeshiva University has the largest enrollment in the mid-60s at a little over 450. Satmar has about 300. Tor Vadas in Brooklyn, a little under 250. And they got much smaller. Near Israel, Neshama in Baltimore has about 200. We talked about Hebrew Theological College in Parm Spiels a little while back, that they're here. This is, of course, before a boom of Vietnam draft dodging. But you get the point, is that Yeshiva University is far and away the largest yeshiva in the United States for those training for the rabbinate and otherwise. This is the official tabulation of Beis Medrash Gavoa that I received from its CEO. It's interesting that they count Kletsk, where Rav Aaron Cutler was Rosh Yeshiva from 1923 until 1940 when he escapes. There's a pause. That's why there's nothing here. The meteoric rise, not really under Rabbi Aaron Cutler, but he dies in 1962. But not enough credit is given to Rabbi Schneer Cutler, his son, in growing the institution. You see Lakewood skyrockets to the point where they have about 6,000 members by 2005. And so my point is that this is no longer the case. We don't have total numbers of the enrollments in yeshivas, but they more or less, Lakewood is the largest, but we see the yeshiva world has the greatest population, certainly in rabbinical institutions. That's a little bit of context. What I want to look at today is other forms of buy-in. Why do Orthodox Jews stay? For example, much discussion still. About tuition crisis. I know. I feel it every single month when my kid's day school draws from my checking account. It's really, really expensive. Aren't people priced out? Well, thank goodness there's a lot of scholarship available. But what I've said, I think I've written in an article that's coming out a little bit, see if I get excoriated for it, is the mentality of many Orthodox Jews is, well, what is the cost? What is the price you would pay for 50 Thanksgiving-like dinners, babysitting, childcare for your children 3 hours a week every Saturday morning, for a social network that would offer a sense of security for when, and God forbid, you have a medical emergency, where there's flooding in your home, when you simply can't rely on AAA and you need somebody else to fix your car tire? How much would you pay for a social network and amenities that would cover so much of your daily, weekly, general needs? And if you ask people, really, The answer is it's worth every penny. And that's exactly how much it costs for most people. Day school is the buy-in in many ways to the Jewish community. There are exceptions, obviously, and I'm not suggesting that it ought to be this way. But the buy-in, the purchase price into the Orthodox community is considerable. For many people, it costs every cent of their paycheck. They do not have a retirement plan. They simply can't afford it. But what they get is so tremendous. But there's another component, which is replacement culture, particularly in the yeshiva world. But I'd argue that it has made its way into all sectors of the Orthodox community. And it is how this community has created parallel structures to either supplement or complement what is healthy and good, or what's perceived healthy and good in the general American community. In the early decades of the 20th century, there was a comeback of the spelling bee. And this is my first example of children's culture. Writes a leading figure of education, W.O. Foreman, journalist, if steps taken to correct misspelling were effective, so there were studies done on spelling bees and its reemergence at the beginning about 100 years ago, then the last week's record, there was a spelling bee taken and studied, should show a large decrease in the total words missed. So to increase literacy, the first week's total for all grades was 4,500, the second 6,500, and the third 3,000. And so it looking like we're going in the right direction. According to the third, people were pushing the spelling bee as an important intervention to increase child literacy. Spelling bee's revival. The old-fashioned spelling bee seemed for a while to have disappeared, almost as completely as the strange performance of Uncle Tom's Cabin. But the latter has begun to come back, we are told, and so has the former. So spelling bee's making a comeback in the 1920s and 1930s, but it was truly, believe it or not, something else in the 1960s, which accounts for why the spelling bee is now televised on annually its final competition, national competition on ESPN, I believe, and much ado over spelling bee in the 1960s onward, and that was Charlie Brown. And that is the, which one? It's one of the Charlie Brown movies. I think A Boy Named Charlie Brown. Forgive me if you're a big Peanuts fan. But here's Charlie Brown sweating. Quite literally, before in a major scene of a spelling bee, and Charles Schulz has much to do with the revival of the spelling bee. This came out in 1969, particularly in the 1970s. And so, while there were many Jewish day schools that quite appreciated the spelling bee, they figured there was another opportunity, not necessarily to replace, but to draw from that program, that educational intervention. To start, this is Rabbi Price over here. We'll get to him in a moment. Of the Bracha Bee, led by Torah U'Mesorah. This is its Olamenu. When I was a kid, Olamenu used to be handed out in my school. I don't think it's around anymore. The idea was originated 5 years ago. So this is in the early 1970s, the idea was originated 5 years ago by Rabbi David Price, principal of the Prospect Park Yeshiva in Brooklyn. Last year, with the cooperation of Torah Mesorah, Rabbi Price made the Brachos be a citywide contest. As schools throughout New York City and suburbs, it was hyper to New York initially. This year, yeshivos and day schools throughout the country were invited to take part in what has become one of the most exciting events of the day school calendar. And here, you see that every year there was an announcement of who were the winners in Olamenu, and this was a magazine that was distributed to virtually all Orthodox day schools at the time in the early 1980s. It was a curious thing, this brachos bee, this blessing bee, and so it made its way. For example, on your left is a clipping from the New York Times. Israel Schenker was reported. If there was an article in the Times about Orthodox Judaism, Israel Schenker was often its author. And he reports on this curious thing called the Bracha Bee. Fast and curious, yet a very good felicity for language. Fast and curious, the questions came. What is the blessing appropriate for almonds? American cheese, angel food cake, apples. Down went contestants on buckwheat, chives, eclairs. I personally let my entire Baltimore community down when I did not know the brecha when I was in second or third grade for Napoleon. For those who are interested, the official brecha is mizono that I knew, but because the cake is so thin, it's actually a bar nefeshet, not an almich. I really haven't recovered. Perhaps this is some sort of atonement for that fateful miscue. Kasha, parsley, finally. Reading books in age six, stumbled on rhubarb, leaving Elaine Whitty eight, the triumphant winner. You see, it fits into a sports culture of contest, of competition, which is really important. We talked just the other week about basketball and yarmulkes and how Judge Shader offered that Jews of all types have the right to play ball, to play basketball, to be a part of competitive American culture. So stubbornly expert with the senior girls. Continuing on, we go to the next paragraph. Among the intermediate boys, the rabbi's questions produce counter questions. Applesauce, homemade or store-bought? The appropriate question, meaning if it's chunky or not. That would decide whether or not it's a shakol or a haitz. As I say this, I realize that I really am hurt by that Napoleon question. I could have been a contender. Pizza's blessings depend on the number of slices. Noted the society's Rabbi Bernard Goldenberg, this is the Torah Mesorah, that is, comes America, comes a cosmopolitan town like New York, and pizza becomes an issue. You can have one slice of pizza as a snack, which takes one kind of blessing, a mizona, but what if you decide to have two slices or three? It's controversial, maybe hamotzi. Then it's not a fast food approach. It's sitting down. I'm making a meal. It's a different blessing. You get the point. Here is Chicago paper. How would you thank God for a strawberry popsicle? And so on. So it's a curious thing. We'll get to how curious it was. It was a big thing. So, for example, EMEC, Hebrew Academy, still around. Very important school in the Los Angeles area. They imported a special judge. Who was it? It was Sephardic chief rabbi, Rabbi Avadia Yosef. Quiz the contestants, and you see that it's moving to the West Coast as well. In Philadelphia, now known as Kasky Torah Academy, Torah Academy of Greater Philadelphia will send four of its students to the national finals. That was a lot. Of the Torah Mesorah Brachas be on Sunday, this is the early 1980s in New York City. The students are Eliyahu Gold, a second grade student, son of Rabbi and Mrs. Aaron Gold, Shalomi Zeiger, a fifth grade student, daughter of Mr. and Mrs. Alan Zeiger. I believe that's Malka Simkovich's sister, if you know Malka, Dr. Malka Simkovich. Mayor Simcha Svei, the son of Rosh Yeshiva Phil Yeshiva, Rav Elia Shvei, a seventh grade student and son of Rabbi Mrs. Elia Shvei. And Malka Kamenetsky, that would be, she'll live and be well, is Rav Shmuel Kamenetsky. So the Rosh Yeshiva Phil Yeshiva sent their children to the Bracha Bee. It wasn't co-ed. There was a boys' division, a girls' division. An eighth grade student, daughter of Rabbi and Mrs. Shmuel Kamenetsky. Apparently, there was something about Philadelphia and the Shvei family in particular that a few the next year, Mayor Simcha Shvei, a seventh grader at Torah Academy, holds his certificate for winning the national Bracha Bee. If you need a bracha, reports the Jewish exponent of Philadelphia, Mayor can say them all. So Philadelphia was something of the vanguard of bracha bees. Here, New York can no longer host all of the different competition by the 1980s. There's an East Coast and a West Coast. Moving forward, a salute to students on both coasts. Bracha bee in the West and the East. Eventually, one of the Pied Pipers moves from Rabbi David Price to Rabbi Eliezer Wenger, first, I believe, in Cincinnati, then in Florida, becomes, again, something of a Pied Piper. He produces a volume, as does NCSY, for Bracha Bees, and there produces study guides. And you can see the they choose the Shabbos scene as a way to demonstrate the proliferation of blessings made. We'll get to that in a moment. So that's Bracha Bee. That's case number one. Number two is a personal favorite of mine. They're all personal favorites of mine. Perhaps are Gedolim cards, or in particular, Torah personality cards. Here is, these are actually copies of my own collection. I have the entire set of, there were six different incarnations. So this on your right is one of my most prized possessions. It is a Rav Moshe Feinstein rookie card. Produced in the late, starting in the late 1980s, when there was a preponderance, there was a huge spike in the baseball trading card world. All of a sudden, collectibles started to skyrocket. It wasn't just about Upper Deck and Topps any longer, but more and more companies came out in the 1980s. And so a Baal Tshuva named Rabbi, or he was a rabbi, he's an accountant, Arthur Sugarman, has an idea. His favorite baseball player was, he's from Baltimore, his favorite player was Brooks Robinson, the great third baseman for the Baltimore Orioles, the human vacuum cleaner himself. Sugarman has an idea. Well, if people like baseball cards, maybe Jewish children will like rabbi cards. He actually appeared on an episode of To Tell the Truth. Nobody could guess that he actually was a the founder of a rabbi card company. It's also important is that this wasn't a totally novel invention. The Agudas Yisrael had already produced some sort of postcard collection of rabbis, but those were in black and white, and they were of rabbis from mostly of Europe from the 19th century. Arthur Sugarman had living and recently deceased rabbinic leaders. Here on the left is a dealer of rabbi postcards, I believe in New York. And again, it is a curious thing that the general and the Jewish press can't get enough of. Students value rabbi cards. Here's Ruderman, the Rosh Hashiva, Rabbi Yaakov Yitzchak Ruderman of Neri Yisrael. And here, in the Providence Journal Bulletin, here you see kids collecting their cards and trading them. Got a little dicey when people all of a sudden you had rabbi rankings and Rosh Feinstein rookie card. You would need the ante in order to obtain that card. You need to trade quite a bit for that. The cards weren't in it originally the size of a baseball card. I forget exactly the size of 1.5 by 3.5 inches is official baseball card. They were a little bigger. Eventually, Torah personality cards shrink to become the size of an actual baseball card. And again, the general Jewish press. So on the left is a page from Sports Illustrated. It's all kosher, about a separate issue. But if you take a look at the second column, at the same time, many Jewish youngsters, even the most sports-minded ones, are turning away from baseball and other sports cards to collect a more meaningful alternative, rabbi cards. Arthur Sugarman, a Baltimore accountant, has issued the first set of 36 cards through a nonprofit company he founded called Torah Personalities. The second set is due out this month. Each card has a color photo of a prominent 20th century rabbi on the front and biographical information about him. In both English and Hebrew, is on the back, says Rabbi Baruch Brohl of Baltimore, who is not one of the rabbis featured, but whose three sons collect the cards avidly. These people are true examples for us, while baseball players may or may not be. Of course, this was the era in which we saw leading lights like Daryl Strawberry and Doc Gooden really crash and burn due to drugs and otherwise. So there were this has, again, context matters. In Newsweek, bubblegum not included. Aryeh Nudel of Baltimore. It wasn't just Baltimore. With an array of Torah personality cards. Hey, I'll trade you a Ruderman for a Feinstein. No, this is not a proposed baseball card swap, but the kind of deal that might occur among children with a religious bent, trading rabbi cards. Since they were introduced last August, more than 400,000 have been sold at 20 cents apiece, or 99 cents for a pack of five, on the back of each 4-inch and 6-inch, 4x6-inch card, so it's about double the size. Printed in English and Hebrew are the rabbi's dates of birth and death, the books he published, and details about his life. created by Arthur Sugarman, and it goes on with materials that we know, well, we already reviewed. Here's a Sports Illustrated. Now, not everybody was so sanguine about rabbi cards. So here in New York Magazine, they feature that there are a number of funny things coming as card collectibles. On the left side, you see Moshe Feinstein from Torah Personalities. And this feature, though, received a very strong critique in the letters to the editor the following issue. Leaders of the pack. There have been many in the Orthodox Jewish communities who have debated the merit of Torah Personalities trading card collection. Those for the distribution of the cards argue that they will allow children to become more familiar with the inspirational leaders of their religion and will help keep the faithful from forgetting a name. Rabbi Moshe Feinstein, whose picture appears in the piece, right here on the left, was a rarity among human beings. The more familiar one became with him, the more one stood in awe of his spiritual greatness, his profound wisdom, his boundless compassion, and his unshakable faith. By printing Rabbi Moshe Feinstein's picture together with cards from the, we'll just read it, Sex Maniacs and Drug War series, New York Magazine, has taken something of beauty and grouped it together with ugliness, proving beyond a shadow of a doubt the argument against distribution of these cards. This is by Cyril Lovovitz from Far Rockaway, New York. Other people complained that it somehow materialized rabbinic personalities by putting them on trading cards, that we should study their Torah wisdom and not collect them in card form. This commodification of Orthodox Judaism, some contended, was a problem. I think Mordechai Gifter of Tel Yeshiva had such caution about it, but when he was told that people are buying them, and it seems to make a difference, he too allowed his picture to be used in Torah personality cards. By the 90s, it spawned, well, even before we got to the 90s, as you can imagine, Yeshiva University rabbinic figures were not included in Torah personality cards. Series 2 had Rabbi Aaron Soloveitchik, but quoted in his statistics, he was Rosh Yeshiva of Yeshivas Brisk in Chicago, not at Yeshiva University. He would be returning. He would by then have already returned. And so the students of the Purim Lampoon of Hamavaser published a little advertisement, Chops, right? Not Tops, but Chops. Chewing Gum presents centrist Orthodox Gedolim cards, a reprinting of the classic modern Orthodox Gedolim set issued 10 years ago. Collect both cards. I have no idea. I have spoken with the editors, people who claim to have been the author of this ad. People, even they debate who the supposed two people. You can guess it's not for now. Either way, what's interesting is that this is the moment in which Rabbi Norman Lamb had written an article in Tradition some 2 years earlier, calling for the change in nomenclature from modern orthodoxy to centrist orthodoxy. The students are using the sudden popularity of rabbi cards to poke fun of the terminological change, but of course, it's just the same reissued thing. Here in a cartoon in a business almanac, you see a political joke about rabbi cards on the bottom left. But people took it quite seriously. They understood the educational value of collecting and becoming familiar with the so-called stats and the images of Torah personalities. And so in Amit magazine in the mid-90s, they review a new fad called Torah cards, not rabbi cards, but events and personalities in the Bible. There have been several in cards. Those were out of, I believe, somewhere in Bergen County. I don't have a set of those, but I remember them. And I think recently rabbi cards have made a comeback. Circle Magazine now produces rabbi cards. They've made something of a comeback. Torah cards, no, this is not a book. This is a trading card sensation. If your child is not already an avid collector of these innovative items, it's time to get a pack or two. Each pack of 7 cards features information, full color illustrations about people's, this is the biblical personalities, events, commandments, or objects described in the Torah. In all, 110 different cards are now in distribution, with more planned to debut soon. I first came across them when they were given to my children by their teachers as prizes. They were educational incentives. Same thing with Torah personality cards with Sugarman for various accomplishments. Wealth of information on each card, so an improved Jewish literacy is impressive. And Hebrew words are transliterated and defined. My 7 and 9 year old boys, as well as their schoolmates in grades 2 through 8, read and trade them voraciously. Which leads me to my final example, and then we'll start to analyze. So we discussed Brachabees. We have learned thoroughly about rabbi cards. And then in the latest invention, this is from 2016. This is from Mishpacha Juniors magazine. Is an interview with the founders of something called Binyan Blocks. And this is really what alerted me to the change in children's culture in the Orthodox world. Building blocks of Binyan Blocks. So here's an interview with one of the founders. One of my partners was building a shul out of Lego with his kids, and he realized that the pieces were really limited in what they allowed you to do. He approached me and said, let's create something that Hamish kids can enjoy. A lot of the Lego themes out there aren't so appropriate for Frum kids. Now, in the last 20 years, Lego has really revitalized itself by not just producing the generic Lego brands and the displays and the minifigures of knights and space scenes and astronauts and pirates, but starting with Star Wars, when it made a comeback in the late 90s, then with Harry Potter, now basically with everybody, Lego has started to introduce popular culture into its Legos. Those are some of its most popular sets. And so all of a sudden, a certain quotient of the Orthodox world apparently felt that Lego was no longer appropriate because it introduced some parts of American culture. A lot of the Lego themes out there aren't so appropriate for Frum kids. We wanted to create Legos that could be used to build the things that are more meaningful. And interestingly, you saw this word before about rabbi cards and meaningfulness to us. We didn't have a lot of experience manufacturing, so we joined forces with a neighbor of his who had experience manufacturing in China. And we looked for a manufacturer who could create the Lego blocks to our specifications. And so they created Binyan blocks, which I don't think it's hard to find now. I think this, I don't think this fad really took, but for a gift for my birthday a number of years ago, my mother bought me the Binyan block shul. And I believe you can buy the yeshiva, you can buy hatsala, you can buy chaverim trucks, you can buy a Shabbos table scene with Lego blocks. So what's happening? Something has happened from the 1970s with Brachabi. Something's happened from the 1970s Brachabi to the 1980s with rabbi cards. Fast forward a couple of decades forward, and we have these kosher Legos. And we now have in Muncie and in Brooklyn and elsewhere, you have entire toy stores dedicated to so-called kosher toys. If you go to Bingo, this sort of kosher Costco that are popping up everywhere in the tri-state area, I should say. If they want to come to Philadelphia, I wouldn't mind either. You see, there are new toys. There are, where you have Fisher Price Little People, now you have these Menchies, this something or other. You have a replacement. And that's what I'm getting at. When you take a look, the Bracha Bee was meant to not replace spelling bees, but it drew inspiration from the effectiveness, from the impact of the spelling bee, which increased reading and child literacy. And they figured, okay, let's use that to increase bracha literacy. Eventually it gave way to Yedios Klalios, competitions. People wanted to move beyond bracha bees and talk about other ideas. That was sort of the fall of the bracha bee in the late 1990s, and we don't really see it, to my chagrin. And I want my kids to atone for my my Napoleon, I guess, complex. That Napoleon the food. It wasn't a short joke at myself. That's what you have with bracha bees. Bracha bees did not mean to replace spelling bees. All of a sudden, with baseball cards and Torah personality cards, an impulse is generated to actually replace, where the Orthodox community looking that it needs to find replacement activities. There is a drive for young boys, although on record, there are many girls in the 1980s who collected these Torah personality cards. But young children wanted to collect baseball cards. They were a fad, a growing fad, beginning in the late 1980s. So Arthur Sugarman and others produced these collectibles that were somehow, not somehow, deliberately meant to replace. Stop collecting Roger Clemens and Greg Maddux and Ken Griffey Jr. Why don't you collect your rabbis instead? And eventually, they make them, have them over there, in small collectible form, and they start to look better. And then this latest iteration actually looks very much like an authentic, it doesn't, they don't, they're not dressed in a helmet or with a baseball mitt, you understand, but they have the optics, the presentation, the shininess of a contemporary baseball card. By the time you get kosher Lego, it's more aggressive, right? It's the idea that why should our children be collecting baseball cards? They ought to be collecting rabbi cards too. No, we need an absolute replacement for Lego culture because it is allowing a certain type of culture to infiltrate our homes that we want to police, says this community. For full disclosure, my children have a vast collection of regular Lego. I'm just reporting the news. And that more aggressive form really betokens something broader about about children's culture. And that brings me back to Peter Berger. How has a growing swath of the more right-wing Orthodox community really flourish in the last 20 or 30 years? It's done that by in a very clever way of taking material culture and branding it and furnishing it for its Orthodox purposes. It has created parallel cultures in our society. It's learned from the very best of American life and applied it in an authentically Orthodox Jewish context. And in no small way, that's how it's survived. And more than that, it's how it's begun to thrive. Whew. Okay. I see they're loaded with questions. So we'll, let's talk about it. Mark, thanks for asking ChatGPT to solve, where does the B come from? Okay. Shelley asks, given the Orthodox antipathy to whatever other religions or secular society does, when is it, again, some parts of the Orthodox community, when is it considered kosher to use and adapt their ideas for Jewish purposes? So this is a section, actually, I wrote this for the magazine, the online magazine Lair House, a number of years ago. I've added to it since then. My repertoire became a chapter, again, my authentically Orthodox book. This is not a plug. If you knew how much my royalties were for book selling, there's no such thing as a plug. Or a monetized plug. But that's exactly what a number of our meetings, maybe a third, have been drawn from these chapters. Is this, and I said it earlier, today is this interesting thing about authenticity. There's no science of authenticity. Regina Bendix, the great French sociologist, she used authenticity and she explained it's a feeling, it's a sentiment. There's no calculus to define what is and what isn't authentic. It's why in a horror film you get scared even though you know nobody was injured in the filming of it. Nothing is actually happening. It's why we all tend to cry at weddings, even though we are very prepared for it. There are certain things that you can't prepare for. They're emotionally based. It draws on our humanity, and that's also what authenticity is for religion. It draws on your heartstrings, pulls on your heartstrings. What makes it work is a combination maybe of marketing, of sentiment, and that it looks right. How does it work? Is a funny thing. It's everything from the rise of bat mitzvah in Orthodoxy in the 60s and 70s to these rabbi cards to Purim spiels as an authentic expression of yeshivas, that you're not a real yeshiva unless you have a Purim spiel. All the different things that we've talked about basketball. You're not a real day school unless you can play ball. And how dare they say that we can't play with our yarmulkes on? All of this is part of an authentic experience. What are the rules and regulations of so-called frum dating? Also has to pass, excuse me, an authenticity test. And so it's all teased out, I think. It's all of the cumulative of what we've been talking about. Tarot cards, Tina. Thank you. Yeah.
Then there's a sub-issue that I'm beginning to think about, which is modern centrist, whatever you want to call it, orthodoxy, who let their kids go to see something like Star Wars or Harry Potter or read it, and we're not considered frum enough by the rest of the community. Rabbi Soloveitchik wasn't on the on J.B. Soloveitchik wasn't on their cards and things like that. Are we moving to the right to try to show that we're just as good as they are? That seems to be what's going on.
So again, I'm not speaking for the merits of it. We're looking to analyze something that happened and maybe to apply and learn from it afterwards. So I get the indignation, certainly. I have a set of shot glasses that friends of mine found on the Lower East Side that have modern, so-called modern Orthodox rabbis on them, including Rabbi Soloveitchik, Israel Hildesheimer, Rav Kook, I believe. It's in my office at work. I'm right now. I'm coming to you from home. So there's certainly ample opportunity for display. Of course, the modern Orthodox say, let's trade baseball cards. Right? There isn't a market necessarily in that community, and so whoever are the suppliers and the originators of it get to decide, and the market gets to decide as well. But I understand the criticism. I remember Art Scroll, when Harry Potter came out, tried, I don't know how successfully, to market a series of kosher Harry Potter. I forget what it was. I recall somebody was in development, but even the Hava, I mean, even the idea of producing it bespoke what we're talking about right now. There needs to be a replacement culture in certain sectors, which is important. Remember, everything in its own context. We talked a lot about the University newspaper, The Commentator, and how they would do a Lampoon issue every year. They too drew inspiration from general culture and applied it to their Orthodox context or their Jewish context.
There is a book of the Torah in or the Torah of Harry Potter. I don't remember the exact title, but it was somebody who wrote this book talking about the confluence of the two, how they were.
There's a whole industry now of Haggadot.
It was poorly written, but it had what to say.
You now have better written. I don't know about this book that you were talking about, Susanna, but there are Haggadahs that we I always try to buy Haggadahs every year. It's a good reminder. Time to get a couple more Haggadahs. There's a Marvel Comics Haggadah. There's a Seinfeld Haggadah. There is a Harry Potter. I think the fellow who did Marvel also did Harry Potter Haggadah. That was quite good. I don't think it's what you were talking about, Susanna, is the Haggadah. It's there's something to it. There was a book about called Wisdom from the Bat Cave came out a number of years ago. A very terrific, a thin book, a really good one, about the application of Batman and drawing out wisdom, a Torah wisdom from Batman. We tend to do it. We tend to do it, certainly.
If I may make a comment,
please.
It seems to me that there's a certain superficiality in this phenomenon, in the sense that Trump having more trouble being able to express myself.
Oh.
But it seems to me that Trump culture is kosher, but anything above Trump culture is usher. And I'll give you an example. When I was at the University of Toronto, my mentor was my economics professor, who was also from WMHO, and set me up on my first student day. The dean, I knew the dean of the arts faculty only because I sat next to him. In short, the dean of the other university in Toronto was also from person. I think that even as we, that the film world in general, and maybe I'm aggregating the Haredi, the most, it seems to me, and the modern Orthodox, as it gets, as it adopts more of
I think this is an American. I understand, and thanks for sharing. I think that on the one hand, there is a superficiality to material culture. But at the same time, let's understand that Oprah Winfrey, for example, Katie Lofton at Yale has written a really good book called The Gospel of Oprah, I think it's called, about how Oprah and her book club, and even how she would give out prizes to her audience members. Material culture matters. I don't know. It maybe it's superficial, but when people own things, it becomes a representation. It's why another good book, it's somewhere here, about a scholar, I think, in Cleveland. A religion scholar did a road trip of all the different religious stuff. When you get things that, you know, when you're tempted maybe a little bit to get off the highway because you see there's the world's biggest donut, the world's greatest whatever. So he did a road trip in which he actually got off the highway with his family and went to all the different religion stops in Midwest America. People like things. And they make meaning out of things. And sure, is it highbrow? No chance. But there is a way that they make meaning of it by its sight, by its touch, by its materiality, which is just a fancy word that academics come up with to mean physical stuff. They may be superficial, but people make meaning out of them. And that was the term people that we see the sources used, whether it be rabbi cards or Legos or bracha bee competitions. See my, oh my, I'm licking my wounds for not winning that bracha bee competition and that Napoleon game. It still haunts me. That's a big deal.
When did baseball cards become equivalent with rabbi cards? That's ridiculous.
It may be ridiculous, but, if you went to, if you did a Mishmar class and you were a fifth grader in 1989, there's a good chance that the rabbi who would oversee it would reward you with a pack of, Torah personality cards and you'd be happy for it.
That makes a baseball card equivalent with a rabbi card.
And that was a lot of the pushback. Again, I'm not suggesting that one should buy into these things. The emergence of them is a really fascinating moment in time in which material culture, particularly children's material culture, really skyrocketed. And it had a lot of power and staying power for the community, whether we like it or not. But again, I just report the news. Anyway, thank you so much. It's really been, I just recognize on the screens and the names. So most of you, many of you, all of you, I've been with for now 10 weeks in a row. And we'll try to start up again. But I really
thank
appreciate
you very much.
The question. It's been a real blast.
Yes.
Thank you.
Bye, everybody.
Thank you.